This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Hurting Code. We are at the Mix Conference in Las Vegas, and I'm talking to Jeff Dalgas and Jared Dixon about Stack Everything. And so we wanted to kind of focus on some of the history and the tech stuff and all that behind the scenes. So I'll just pass it over and you guys can introduce yourself.
My name's Jeff Dalgas, and I've been doing software development for quite some time. I joined Jeff Atwood and Jared. It's been about 2 years? Three years. Wow. Yeah. Just started working on Stack Overflow with these guys. I was the third person that was brought into the team, and Jared and Jeff had already had something going. And so, yeah, that's my little bit of history for me.
Hello, I'm Jared Dixon, and I'm also a developer with Stack Overflow, now Stack Exchange. And I was lucky enough to have Jeff Atwood ask me to come and work with him on a new project about 3 years ago. And after it blossomed into, you know, what became Stack Overflow, and Jeff and Joel have done like an amazing job, you know, getting the community worked up about this. And that's pretty much my history. I'm a software developer for the past like 8 or 9 years. So
you guys were saying earlier that you had both worked with Jeff before. And I thought that was kind of interesting. So, Jeff, you were saying you worked on some 911 software?
Yeah. So when I was a young whippersnapper, one of the first jobs I had was working with Jeff Atwood. The story goes, I was living in Washington State, going to college, getting my associate's degree there. And Jeff Atwood was with a company called 911 Incorporated. And his team flew in to work on a 911 system that I happened to have connections with, like the city. I was working for the city at the time. Anyway, the long story short is that he identified me as being a geek, fellow geek, and so thought he could mold me into a real geek, I guess. So he basically had the company we were working for fly me out, and just started working with Jeff at that company and doing 911 systems in Visual Basic. Visual Basic 6. That scares you. It should.
Are they still Visual Basic 6 is the question.
I sure hope not.
So was it a back-end system then, or was it like...
No, it was through and through everything from the front end all the way through to the back end. At that time, it was a lot of... The cool part that I enjoyed the most was it's interfacing directly with PBX switches and 911 switches, and getting interfacing with the telcos. The software was basically designed so that when the phone call rings at the dispatch center, the operator answering the call has all of the information about who that person is, maybe history of what they've, any medical history that they have, anything that they know basically about that person needs to pop up before the call is even answered.
Okay. So, and then Jared, you and Jen and anyone else worked with Jeff at GlaxoSmithKline?
Yes, Jen, he's our designer on Stack Exchange sites, and myself, we were lucky enough to work with Jeff back at the big pharmaceutical company. And Jen wasn't really in our group that much whenever I was with Jeff. We were sort of together early on. But the way that I got to know Jeff was... He was the only other person there that sort of had a passion. I mean, you could just tell, like, the way he was the only, he had three monitors, you know, no one else. I had two, and I was like all jealous when I first saw him. And, but he really had a passion. And I think he could tell that I also had a passion for software development. You know, a lot of the people, I don't mean to disparage them, but you could tell they're there just for the money. I mean, it was a great job. But like in team building exercises, we found out like both of us were the only children. Like we had all these sort of picadillos that no one else had, and they're like, oh yeah, okay, we understand what's going on with those two guys. You know, they're nerds through and through. So I was fortunate enough to he moved on and tried to get me to go out to California, I guess, Vertigo Software, and I wish everything worked out now, but it's, you know, sometimes I wish I'd gone out to California to work, you know, at a place that makes software, but everything has turned out great, so.
Right.
So when you guys got started, we were talking earlier about, like, I'm sure everyone was just doing a little everything, but we were saying, Jeff, you were doing, focusing on MVC, and then, Jared, you were doing more of the, like, jQuery stuff, and.
I think we basically did, I guess we sort of made the system, like, we had different responsibilities in the system. Like, I guess I was, did most of the work around voting, client voting, and, so you had worked on a lot like the user pages,
right?
Jeff.
Yeah, user pages, and it seemed like every day we just had a feature, and it kind of just whatever line that there wasn't a specific role for either one of us, just basically get it done, whatever it took, just to get it done and get it out there to the people. But, so.
Was there like a really clear vision sort of from the beginning of what all the pages would be, or were you guys kind of discovering that as you were going along?
Have you ever known Jeff to not have a clear vision of anything?
Yeah. Jeff and Joel, I mean, they had basically what they wanted, like the core of the system, you know, like the melding of a Q&A site with, you know, like the voting reputation system, like Dig and Reddit. So we pretty much knew what we wanted to build, or they, you know, they knew what they wanted to build, and we got to help build it. So
one of the things with, you know, when you got a group of people working remotely, one of the things that's always fun to handle is the data. You know, like, did you run a local database and keep all that schema stuff in sync, or have a group server that you used, or what?
Yeah. So we started off with an idea that we could use the database, built-in database project that was in Visual Studio. And that worked for a while. And we kind of did our changes there. But for a lot of the, I'll be honest, a lot of the time we were making changes directly with our local copy, making sure it tests out well. And then we distribute the device SQL scripts, you know, manually. So there, I'll be straight up. It's embarrassing, but it works. It was a very pragmatic approach to it. There was nothing that was solid engineering. Now, since then, we've kind of gotten a little more process involved, and now we have a migrator tool that actually does execute. We're still writing the raw SQL by hand, but we have a migration tool that takes care of the distribution of that, since we're now at a larger scale than one database.
Is that a custom migration system you guys wrote?
Yeah, that's something Sam put together. He wrote, it's just a real simple app that just takes your SQL that you write, does a checksum against it, keeps a result in a migrations table, whether it's been run or not, and makes it simple. It's really, really lightweight.
Okay, so you're using that both in dev and production then?
Yeah. So when we make a database change or a schema change of any sort, we'll build our SQL up, to run it locally, making sure it works. And the way we write the SQL is so that we can run it multiple times, you know, if checking to see if an existence of an index or a table before we'll actually do an alter, that kind of thing. So if it does get run more than once, it's not going to hurt anybody.
This is the one time I get to say idempotent. I love that word. So remote, and then you were using Subversion then, checking code in and out. Do you still use Subversion?
No, not anymore. That's probably one of the other pain point that Jeff has. Well, we all do. We all fight with it a little bit, but we've gone to Mercurial now. And it's a transition that was tough to make. I mean, it's a little different model than what we had been used to in Subversion. But it's worked out. I mean, we commit so often that the problem we run into is that you're always merging, constantly. And it seems that you can push code up, and 5 minutes later, somebody else has already gotten some code in before you, so you're having to pull and push and do a lot of merging. And so, we moved to Mercurial.
Okay. Did you guys look at Git as well? Was there any kind of just...
Well, Joel's company, Fog Creek, they have a product called Kiln that integrates very nicely with like their bug tracking system, FogBugs. And Joel has written like an awesome Mercurial tutorial. I think it's like HG and it out there. So I guess there really wasn't any question when we wanted to go to a more distributed source control system, like it was going to be HG. And it's fine. I like the way it works. I like to split. I'll pull from the remote repo just to one local repo, and then I'll clone the local repo, like for any feature that I need to work on. So it kind of works the way that I like to, my workflow. So.
So, you guys are devving along. How do you decide, okay, this is time for this thing to go out to? Do you have stage servers? Do you have production? Like, what's the flow of, you know, how something gets out?
It's all magic, really. That's all.
Next question, then.
There's unicorns involved. We know there's that.
Yeah, you have seen the unicorn, so you understand. So we'll do our development on our feature that we're working on locally, and, once we get it to a point that's fairly stable, we'll push it, or sometimes before that. and what happens is it gets into Mercurial. We have cruisecontrol.net set up so that it's, you know, pulling those changes into a dev tier every probably couple minutes. And if there's any changes, it'll pull them down, run the build on our dev tier, and allow us to have other people look at it as well. And most of the time, we'll throw a feature over the wall or to another person and say, hey, you know, this is look okay. We'll just kind of sanity check each other. So it's kind of, there's not a whole lot of process in it, other than the tooling makes it very simple to push, to check. We do have some very basic unit tests as well that handle some of that. So, so the sanity checks, we should probably be using those more, but I'll let Jared get into that.
How much has that process changed since the early days? I mean, has it gotten a little bit more formal as you guys have gone along, or are you still pretty loose?
You're still somewhat loose, I would say. We're pragmatic, again. Just the simplest possible thing that can work. We've gotten better with... we've always been using cruise control to do our building, and that process hasn't really changed much. So I guess I didn't finish the whole, the long story.
Yeah, there. Yeah, yeah.
So the other part of it is after we do get a validation and that it, whatever our feature is that we're working on did succeed, the next phase is to, we have three-tiered deployment. The next phase is to go to production with it on Meta. And Meta's our site that seems that people understand that when you're living in Meta, you're kind of going to, you subject it to something, it might be awesome and it might not. but those features go out there first before they get to deployed to the others tier, we call them, which is stack, super user, server fault, and all of the other stack exchange sites. And then if the feature survives that far without any explosions, then we'll go to the Stack Overflow.
So Meta's the beta site,
yes.
Basically.
Yes.
Very beta. I didn't realize that.
Or Meta's alpha, and then the beta is Stack everything else, and then Stack. So just Stack Exchange is the final place to deploy then.
Stack Overflow is the final.
Oh, sorry, Stack Overflow.
Yeah, Stack Exchange is the others. It's included in that now. So we do have multi-site tenancy, and those basically just mean we have three web servers that when we're ready to go live with those three, which is our others tier. We'll just build those as a group, and those then, all the sites that have that we're hosting from those three servers get the new changes.
Okay, so how does that physically happen? You've got your build; it's you're ready for it to go into production. How does that deployment happen?
Okay, so we have a cruise control dashboard set up, and we have cruise control installed on all of our web tiers. Each tier builds itself independently from all the others. So when we build, we have the ability to go in and build each individual server, but we have groups set up. And when we build our meta tier, it's just building one of our servers. That's just where we call it Web 10. It's kind of our staging ground or alpha or beta, whatever. Yeah. So when we build meta, that's one. We build others, then that's going to be three of our servers that kick off. And it goes through a full compilation, minification for all the JavaScript and all our static resources. And then the last step is to actually take the site offline for a short period of time while that new code is copied, and then it brings the site back up. So the downtime is very minimal. It's maybe, 15 to 20 seconds.
Okay. Yeah. And then do you have some, there's spin-up time on a .NET site when it's coming up. That includes that time too?
It's... There's some spin-up time, but we do have caching in another layer now. We've moved a lot of our caching to Redis, And so it's not like we're having to spin up everything into it, some of it's already warm. So there's not it's not a full cold start. So it does spin up pretty quick. I mean, within 15 seconds.
Do you have like cache and validation stuff that, you know, if something in Redis needs to be purged or, you know, with a new version of the build?
I've been talking for a bit. Well, I guess our cache and validation, it might be a little bit ghetto in this regard, isn't it? It's like, basically, if there's something that really needs to come out of Redis, we can either pull it out manually or just change the key, you know? It's a little bit ghetto, but it works, so.
So, can you talk about how Redis is implemented, how you got that set up?
Yeah, so Kevin Montrose did a lot of the work early on our Redis layer, but we actually used Redis Sharp. Miguel built an open source library for speaking with directly to Redis, and we've kind of taken that and molded it into something that we need that would work for us. And now I think at this level, we have Mark Gravel, which he's pretty high user, rep user on Stack Overflow. I'm sure everyone will recognize his name. But he's working on making that cache layer just really streamlined, really efficient. And I think by now, I think it's already been announced that it's open source. So you can go out and check it out yourself.
I think we had in the initial versions of our Redis library, we had some locking and that was actually causing some bottlenecks. You know, if every time you need to go to the cache, you have to lock. Gravel has like totally removed all that. So like the caching layer it's extremely speedy now.
So why'd you guys pick Redis versus some other solution?
Kevin can speak directly to that. But it basically boiled down to the timing that we were in. Velocity was still in kind of in beta at that point, and in order for us to utilize, we would have had to take a pretty big hit on the upgrade path because we weren't at 4.0 at that point either. So it would have been a huge, a larger investment then for us at that point. But he'd also done some looking at it in analysis that basically pointed it to fitting our needs best.
The Redis library or the Redis cache, it's very feature rich. And this is what really caught all of our attention, like all the different things you can do with Redis that just really weren't supported by any other caching software. So,
and we're doing some interesting things. Before we had kind of built a caching layer on top of HTTP cache, and we were using that internally, but we would do things like instead of just storing strings, like a lot of times if you need a lot of, you know, huge storage of a string, and that was majority of what we were caching, is HTML fragments. Then we'll gzip that so that the storage requirements for those are even lower than a traditional cache. So that makes that part of it a little less heavy.
Yeah.
So we do the same thing with Redis now through our layer, through the caching layer, that if you put a string in it, it's going to zip it up before it goes in or out. So
cool. What other sort of things have you had to do as you've scaled, you know, that are from a software point of view of how you've kept up with the scale? Because you're still on such a few number of servers.
Yeah. We've been pushing a lot of features, and obviously with hiring new team members and bringing in more people, I'll just tell you the stories then. As we brought in more and more people and added more features, our platform actually did get a lot heavier. Like we were running a higher CPU usage than we had ever ran that was a couple of weeks ago, at least a month ago or so. And so we had to go in and pay down our technical debt. We just spent 2 weeks dedicated to nothing but performance. And it was just a stop everything you're doing, no more features. You're going to nail this thing. And so, you know, we were experiencing some pain in all around locking, like Jerry had mentioned, in our Redis caching. There's a lot of new complicated technologies that we were sort of kind of getting in there. And at scale, you don't see these things until you get to a certain scale. And then some of our weak spots start showing up, you know. And then it was just a matter of dedicating our time to those 2 weeks, and literally dropped from our CPU usage dropped from, I don't know, running around 50 or 60% at some points, down to like now we're 10%, 15% most of the time, if that. So, yeah.
What are some specific, I mean, you just watched what was hot and, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of it, I guess we did a lot of tuning around the database, and like Sam Saffron, he made a really good page on the site for us developers to look at that show like the hottest queries, like which queries are taking the most database CPU time, which ones are taking the longest to run. So that's allowed us to actually go in and find the pain points very easily. If you ever talk to Sam, he'll complain that that's not exposed by default. It's something that needs to be exposed to everyone that's working with SQL Server, like how to get at that information. We've also worked with Brent Ozar, who's like, he's like the god of SQL Server. He knows everything about it. So he's been extremely helpful in getting, helping us tune our indexes and, our table access. So
did you guys find that it was mostly database stuff, or was it all over the system?
There was a few things. Database was a big one. What was some of the others?
Search.
Oh, yeah. We had moved to Lucene.net, which is, basically we decided that we needed a new search implementation. And we were using full text indexing before for a lot of those, just passing it off to SQL Server to say, hey, you know, just give us the best results back, which worked. It worked a lot of the time, some of the time not so well, you know. But basically, we were paying a cost on the database, on one server, to do that. And so we decided when we switched, to make a switch, to move the search from the database layer over into the web tiers. So now we have scaling. Now we can put it on end servers, and it will scale. And we're not paying that cost on the database anymore. Full text is very fast, it's very performant, but we were seeing some backing up in some of the it must be contention, but we weren't exactly able to establish what that was. But when you get a lot of queries happening, a lot of inserts happening, a lot of reading and writing, you just start to it impacts that full text search performance to some small degree that we could see at scale.
So I've seen things like there's posts on high scalability and other places where they'll talk about, you know, like what's in your stack and stuff. And, so it's, you know, you've got the MVC SQL Server kind of core running the app. And then you have a lot of kind of open source utilities. A lot of them on Linux lately that are kind of handling caching layers and stuff like that. Do you see those working well together? Has that been can you just talk about, you know, what you've done there?
Sure. Let's see. How do I start?
HA proxy.
Okay.
I mean, you got to talk about HA proxy. It's like, it's the first one that we added, right? I mean, basically. And you said it, like Jeff Dog has set it up, our load balancer. It's amazing. HA proxies, it blows me away every time I see how much flows through it, and it just keeps chugging along.
So. Yeah. So instead of going with a physical piece of hardware that does load balancing, we went with an open source app and happened to one of the... Willie was the guy, Willie Taru. I think that's maybe mispronouncing his name, but he was not an active, but he was a member on Stack Overflow. He answered people's questions, but I noticed he was a really active guy on the Usenet groups, and we just made a decision we needed load balancing, and we could buy something, or we can use open source software, and I happen to be a guy who enjoys Linux, so we just went with that. With an open source solution.
Cool. Yeah, I think, you know, I've seen different takes on those posts and stuff, but what I thought is, you know, it's not a thing where you have to completely choose, like, I'm a this person or a that person, you know, and it's like, I think there are a lot of those utility things out there that it's like, you know, pick the best one, and, you know, that you can continue working with whatever stack you've got and not, you know, buy into, you know, like, whatever religion or whatever.
I think a lot of times Microsoft developers, if you use anything of Microsoft, you're already like, everyone assumes that that's all you can use, you know, and I think hopefully we're a good example of that you can choose, you know, alternatives from the open source community, not even running on Windows, you know, use Linux where it fits your needs. We'll try to diversify. So.
Cool. So, we were talking earlier a little bit about like how the dev team works and everyone remote. Now with the team growing even more, what do you know? How does that work? Do you have like intranet? Do y'all get into your SharePoint.
SharePoint servers, TFS with your work items.
Yeah, first of all, it's all enterprise class. We've upgraded. No, we're just, I think as a team, we seem to mesh well, right? I mean, that's the biggest part is we have personalities and talent that's just amazing. It's like a dream team, basically. I'm having a blast working on this because I get to work with some really smart, ambitious people that get things done. And for me, that's what keeps me going every day. And I think a lot of the team members just respect each other for that. So as far as what we do, how we work, it's very simple. Skype constantly. Everything we do is we have a team chat and there's all discussions happen. It's almost like we're all in the same room together. All discussions for anything that happened there. And then every week we have two meetings, one on Tuesdays and one on Thursdays now. And we'll just talk for an hour. What's happening? What have you been doing? But a lot of the time we can watch the commits that are happening every day. And there's a lot of them now. So we'll just pull down the latest code, look at revision history, look at the code. And if there's anything that jumps out at you, like then you just mention it, you know, there's something weird going on. Or I don't like your stuff. What are you doing? You know, a lot of questions at that point. And usually it's me, you know, so I'll admit it.
How do you handle, you mentioned before Kiln and stuff, do you have like a, you know, formal bug tracking system or is it kind of more?
Well, we kind of eat our own dog food. That's what Meta is for. Like, in addition to, of course, our error logs that when we have unhandled exceptions, we get notified. We have just a wonderful community that wants our software to succeed and they'll let you know pretty quickly, you know, with a Meta post, that, hey, this is broken or giving you feedback on it. So we eat our own dog food.
Well, other people eat your dog food.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody's eating
dog food. You watch them eat the dog food and see how they react.
Exactly.
See if they like it, if it's tasty for them.
You know, that reminds me of something that I've seen is, you know, people have asked at times if it was possible to run their own copy or if you would sell or whatever is that something that gets talked about ever?
Selling the Stack Exchange as a service, more or less.
Right.
Well, I think it was tried early on as selling it as a service model on the 1.0 version of Stack Exchange. And it learned pretty quick. Jeff wasn't excited about it when it first, the idea came up. But we did try it. I mean, it was something we were like, well, if we'll let anybody with a credit card open up a Stack Exchange site on whatever topic happened to be interested in. But what we quickly learned is that the community doesn't equal a credit card. That model just didn't work.
Yeah.
And so we moved away from that pretty quickly.
What I was meaning was more like a local installer. I want to have a private thing for bug tracking. Like, you know, could I run my own bug tracking on...
Oh.
That's a random idea. Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe better.
Probably not. I would suggest go looking at fog bugs.
No. Right. okay, a little break. Yeah, is there any other stuff we should talk about? And
you want to talk about the monitoring stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Stuff.
Okay. Yeah, so you were talking...
So you guys... I understand have some instrumentation on the site, so you are constantly monitoring, you know, how the site is behaving, and you could tell us a little bit about how that works.
I've seen it demonstrated. You remote desktop in, and you look at task manager.
You missed it. It's called Hanselmanning in to production. Yes. No, the way we have a couple of leaderboards, and Jared had mentioned one already, and that's the SQL leaderboard. And if you're on the top of that list, you're in the wall of shame. So everyone knows to watch that thing carefully and just make sure the queries you're writing don't end up on the top of that list. And everyone's, again, pragmatic about it, so we're just paying attention. And I think that's the biggest thing. Also, another one of our dashboards is open source software called Nagios, and our sysadmins helped get that running up. I had a smaller version of it in CAC called Cacti running before that, and it's still actually operating in our Oregon data center. But it does is the big three monitoring, and that's the CPU, memory consumption, and bandwidth. And generally, if you see a spike in any one of those three, you could kind of, you either have to correlate that with a deployment, or maybe some rogue traffic that's happening that might come in, or, you know, there's just some thread that's out of control and you need to figure out what exactly is going on with that. There's been a cases where we have a few rogue regexes that had popped their head up, and just because they were, you know, had some issues that they don't show up until you have certain types of data come through, you know. So those are interesting. Sam has written a nice CPU analyzer tool that's just a real simple app that connects directly to a process and dumps the call stack at that moment. So you could just take a snapshot of whatever's happening. If there's a box that's going out of control, you just take a snapshot of that and look at the log files and just, you know, figure out exactly where in the call stacks you're seeing a lot of these issues.
So I know that some of these tools have been open sourced, or can you talk about which ones have
So I think the push to go open source has always been a desire and a goal of Jeff's since the project start, really. So we're not gonna, I don't think that it's ever gonna be an open source platform, the whole thing, as an open source component. But a lot of the things we do on the outskirts of our project will become open source, and we're starting to do that more, with Redis being one example. That library is open source. The other's going to be, I'm not sure about the
loose. An OpenID. We're going to try to provide like the reference implementation of an OpenID provider on .NET. Yeah. So Kevin Montrose is working on that, and we'll integrate that into all of our sites. But
make sure you give that to Microsoft.
Maybe. Yeah.
Another one that recently was Dapper, which is an interesting library that we came out of a need for speed. Another need for speed. Linked to SQL in some areas was being stressed to the point in a lot of our hot code paths that just we needed it to be faster, even faster than linked to SQL can provide. So I toyed with doing a data reader first, but found quickly if you do it using straight strings, it's going to be as fast, really fast, but it's going to be really difficult to maintain that. Sam came up with a library called Dapper. And that's out there on Google Code now. And you can download that. And it's a simple, lightweight framework to basically just dynamically generate, take a SQL statement, a select statement, and it'll map that directly using a data reader into an object, a Telepoco object. And works. It's simple. It's fast. That's what we needed.
What about any of those performance tools? Like you were talking about some of the, like that process dumper and stuff like that.
I'll have to talk to Sam. I think that might be...
I want that.
It's like it might. I'm not sure if it's already on his site or not. I don't know. We'll have to figure that out. But I'm sure that's definitely something that, because that tool is one he happened to have in his back pocket. And you're like, here, use this.
Sam's magic tool.
Yeah. So we started using it, and right away we learned it was very valuable. So it's nice to have that.
So as the team's grown, funding coming in, all that, how have your two roles changed over time?
Sit back and, you know, watch the money roll in, you know? I don't have to do anything.
Actually, you're architects now,
that's
right?
That's right.
You don't mess with that code
stuff. That's right. Actually, I don't think anything's really changed. I guess now, since there's more people, Jeff can, like, share the pain around. You know, whenever he assigns his buckets of blame, it's like, oh, it's not just Dalgus and myself that are getting them now. So, but it's been real interesting to have the caliber of developers that we now have. So that you can go and rely upon them, you know, to give you aid. It's like having your own personal Stack Overflow, you know, right there. So
yeah, I think that's it. Jared said just the caliber of the team, and you pick the guys that you get to pick your eight winning team, and Jeff does a good job of that. So
it's funny. It's kind of a little bit like it's similar to like the careers.stackexchange, like the you know. A lot of the people are some of the highest contributors on, like Mark especially being an example, but, you know, that's cool. So they both, you know, that they know what they're talking about and they're passionate about the site, know how it works. They know how to post an answer right away and then go back in and edit it later.
Not a game the whole time.
Yeah.
Against the tricks. Fastest gun in the West.
Right. You know, you talked earlier about the multi-tenancy. Can you explain a little bit more why you're doing that, how you got to that point, and, you know?
Yeah, so when we first started, we thought we only had to worry about one site to begin with. And then when we opened up two sites, the model was simple, or it was supposed to be. It started simple, in that we'll just bring up another IIS instance. We'll just name it Server Fault, since that's where our second site that we had opened. And same with Meta. I think we had Meta then, too, right? Yeah. So we just decided that we'll just start new IIS instances for each one of these sites that we bring online. And as soon as we had... Well, we still had our three core sites, Stack Overflow, Super User, and Server Fault, and Meta, I guess that being our fourth. And so we went to do the Stack Exchange model. That was kind of taken on by the New York team. At that point, we decided, okay, there's a new need now. We're going to try this model of pay for Stack Exchange site and see if this works. And the New York team took the code that we had written at to that point and basically reforked at that point. And they created a customized version of of the code we had already written. And in doing so, they went with the same scaling model that we had started with, in that you just bring a new IIS instance up for every site you want to bring online. Well, quickly, they had several hundred sites, people with credit cards wanting to start their site. So, and every one of these was an IIS instance with their own worker app pools and their own worker processes. And it just, at running all of that off of one server, we quickly reached a point where that tipped. IIS is capable of running many, many IIS sites at once, but the way we had, there was just enough contention going against those sites that CPU was just overwhelming. So when we changed gears, we took a lot of lessons learned. They had done some work towards the end of that in working out a way to do a single IIS instance and bring all the site settings into a single place. And so we had that was the primary lesson learned, I think. If nothing, we didn't learn anything else from that experiment, was that there was no way we were going to be able to scale our sites using the N rule of IIS instances.
Right.
we just basically spent some time figuring out how we're going to bring our code into a place, get to a place where we can run one instance of IIS and switch out the database connection based on whatever host headers come in. So now it works that way. I mean, you connect to our site using whatever URL you're going to hit. It's going to be the same IIS instance for almost all of the sites that are running on that one box, and the data will come from one database or another. We still have a lot of databases, but the connection strings just get swapped out on whatever you're connecting to.
So it's the exact same physical application running. It swaps out the data, and then it's also got to do some different things, so it looks different, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so every site has a folder that has our static resources, and we have some shared resources that are just JavaScript files, your typical things you need to run a site. And then the skinned sites have their own CSS and their own image folder, so they can look the way that they want to look.
Okay, and so those includes are just if this, then.
Well, we have, I guess, a site object, one for every site. It knows its settings, its properties, its paths. So basically the code is the same. It's just we have this nice helper object, a static class called current. So you can always get from current, like the current database, current site. So anywhere you need a path, like a path to the image folder, to the CSS, you just say, like, current site, CSS, current site, image folder, stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all the site visual customization is all done in CSS. It's basically a big,
yes,
your own little CSS Zen garden.
For the most part, we do use less for making the CSS sane. You know, if you have 50, 60 sites, it gets a little complicated. But Benjamin Dumke, he did a lot of work on getting less set up for us so that, and Jin Yang, our designer, he uses a Mac. Of course, he's like, if you're a designer, you've got to be on an Apple product. But he doesn't have the ability to run Visual Studio locally, and who doesn't have Windows installed. So we've got Les set up so that Jin can actually hit a path, and it'll do all the conversions that he needs. So you know, we got to accommodate, you know, the designers.
So you've got that, and then also as far as minification and stuff, what?
That's a part of the build. I guess that's one part of the build that has grown over time. You know, we've identified places where we need to make what we send to the client as small as possible. So it's a post-build step, or in our MS build, that goes through and minifies the CSS and the JavaScript, and goes through some of the files and does replacements. Like, oh, if you had our master.js here, it should be master.min.js. It just does some swapping around.
So how much work is it for you guys to spin up a new site, you know, something that comes out of beta or whatever?
In fact, I have to do one of those sometime this week, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Until the end of this podcast.
Yeah. So to start a new site is pretty simple now. There's a few... okay, so Area 51 is our new site staging ground. I'm sure people are aware of that. If not, you should go there and propose a site for us, or vote one up or commit to another. But there, once we have an official commitment, we have 100%. It goes through several stages through a vetting process, so, as well as through the community and discussion. And there's a lot that happens before the site is launched. But after that launching part, it's pretty uneventful. It's a matter of, well, hopping in, plugging in the information that we've collected through the Area 51 proposal, like for important things like who the audience is, what the topic is going to be, the name of the site, host address, all those simple things. And those are all, there's just a new site creation page that is set up that basically just, once you got all that information, you plug it in, you click a button, and it's going to generate a SQL script that will create all of the new database, the new tables, and anything that goes along with, and it'll run, then we just run that to create the database. And migrations happen after that, so then we just have a fully functional database that's ready to go. And the rest happens through the site settings object that Jared referred to. Every site gets a new set of settings, and you can tweak them as you will, and that's how it works.
Yeah. One thing I'd forgotten to ask about earlier. You guys recently upgraded to MVC 3 then? And yes. You were telling me that you just converted your master page recently over to use a Razor layout.
Yeah, that was an exciting day. Yeah, Mark had been doing a lot of work on, we all kind of shared the burden, some more than others. I didn't do a whole lot myself, to be honest with you. But, the master page was the last thing that happened. There were still a lot of ASPX pages that it hooked into the old master, site.master. And so once we got that over to Razor, now everything's Razor. So
cool. And working well for you.
Yeah. Razor's great. It's so nice to not see bee stings everywhere. Yeah. So we're happy with that. It's a very nice way to express markup and code.
So what is the most annoying thing about MVC? What has bugged you? You guys have been working since very early on. What is the one thing that's not there that you wish was?
Shoot.
I don't know.
I'm trying to think.
Yeah. One of the things, you did some work with the route attribute. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
Yeah, whenever we first started with MVC, I mean, it was such a breath of fresh air. That my previous life, I was like basically writing just HTTP handlers just so I could get that functionality, so I wouldn't have to deal with web forms. But I didn't like the way that routes were expressed, like in the global ASX file. I thought that it made more sense to put the route right there on the action, so you know, like, oh, look, this is what the URL is for this action. It's how I get to it, instead of having to swap back and forth. I mean, our app now has like 500 or 600 routes.
Wow.
I mean, I wouldn't want to have to go digging into the global. And we even have some places that some controller actions that don't have routes associated with them, but just so they can be reused. So it's like, how would you know that didn't have a public route? So we have just an attribute that sits on top of any public action result controller action that basically decorates the route.
Okay.
And there's constraints on it that you can add in. Like you could say, oh, this route parameter, it's an ID, so it needs to be an integer. So all that's handled, you know, through the regex constraints that you can place on routes and the route collection.
Yeah. It's really slick. I mean, when you're looking at a method, you can see what route you're going to have to use to get to it. And it's very clear, you know, what type of other things we have also, like an exerf handler, whether it's a get or a post request, and whether we're going to use the RF key or not, or token. So, yeah, it's really slick. And that's one thing I wish it was kind of, you know, in the box, if you will. But maybe it can be if you open source it.
Yeah. I want to actually have a blog post about that. But other than that, MVC is wonderful. I had dabbled in Rails before starting with Stack Overflow, and that's one of the great things. I was so glad that MVC was in beta, and I could use that, like, that whole paradigm. So
I'm not out of questions. I have no idea how much time has elapsed.
A lot of talk. If we cut it down and make it
right. I'll speed it way up. Okay.
There's a lot you could throw out, I'm sure.
that was great stuff, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, okay. I guess we're all done then. So thanks a bunch.
Yeah. We're a big fan of your show, obviously. Yeah. I've listened to your show a lot, so it's awesome.
We're big fans of your site.
Group hug, everyone. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye.